Yeah, I think I can begin today's Dhamma talk. I forgot what day it is. It was the third or the fourth day, but something like that, of this nine-day retreat of Easter 2010. And yesterday I talked about the five hindrances and a couple of other ones as well. And I did promise today to talk about the seven factors of awakening, the Bojanga. And there is a reason for that. And he's just pointing out that in the very earliest strand of Buddhism, those two always went together as overcoming the hindrances to get the enlightenment factors or the awakening factors, to get the awakening factors to overcome the five hindrances. And if there was a very simplified form of Buddhist practice, that was basically it. Overcome the hindrances, develop the enlightenment factors, and that was your practice. They all seem to go together, and scholars who know even better than I seem to say that that is a very, very early strand of Buddhism. So they usually go together, hindrances and factors of awakening. And many of you will know those factors of awakening just as a prologue to go through them very quickly and then give some more details and flesh them out and how they actually relate to your practice here. Those factors are mindfulness, sati, it's contemplating Dhamma, Dhamma vicaya, energy, joy, piti, tranquility, usually of the body, and also a bit of tranquility of mind, the stillness, the samadhi, and the equanimity. But in all the times they're mentioned in the suttas, there's always a little prologue. It said they're based on seclusion. We awaken this citta. And so this whole enlightenment factors, which are the antidote to the hindrances, and actually what happens when the hindrances disappear, even the Buddha said they're based on this idea of seclusion. And it's one of the reasons why we go on retreat, because it offers that opportunity, very rare in your world, of having seclusion, having your own room, your own space, silence, being away from the family, being away from the business, being away from the world. And just that's one of the reasons why people love coming on retreats. We used to have this retreat centre in North Perth, and it was a sort of almost secluded, being a little compound in the middle of the city. But nevertheless, it doesn't have the same seclusion as being outside of the city, in the countryside, in an area of land which is surrounded by trees. It's one of the great advantages of this location. You look north, east, south and west, you just see trees and forest. So it's a very beautiful location. It gives you the idea of seclusion. And that very idea of seclusion, what sometimes we call the perception of seclusion, is something very valuable and very helpful to one's practice. Which is why I've encouraged many of you that if you find that sitting in this room doesn't offer you enough seclusion to incite the still and peaceful mind, sit in your room, find a nice quiet place in the grounds of this area over here. Sit on the stupa. There is actually a very secret meditation garden somewhere on this property which Philip A. Kakata discovered. If you ask one of the monks, they can probably show you where it is if you haven't found it yourself, or ask one of the caretakers. A very beautiful place just on the other side of the dam where you can just sit quietly. There's many places where you can have sort of some seclusion, and that's a beautiful thing to have, because once you have the seclusion, that gives some energy and power to these other factors which are all part of the meditative practice. Even like mindfulness, you know that just when you congregate together, there are going to be talking, there are going to be glances, there are going to be some sort of body communication, body language. And that sort of tends to disturb the mind. But in seclusion, when you're by yourself, that tends to give the mind enough stillness to create powerful mindfulness. And, as you know, that in my life I've been privileged to have opportunities of seclusion. And the biggest amount of seclusion was the 6 months of silent retreat. And it's amazing, you don't see people, you don't talk to people, and you have incredible amounts of power come up in your mind. And it's just, you're not doing anything, it's because you're not doing anything. You don't create this, it's just what happens when you stop creating. It's because in seclusion you get some very, very powerful mind states. So first of all, these enlightenment factors or awakening factors are based on seclusion. And if you tend to associate too much with one another, talking to each other, hanging out with each other, that does actually weaken one's mindfulness. It draws off the energy from the mind. And even if you like sitting in this room, you close your eyes, because when you close your eyes, that gives you the almost like the atmosphere of seclusion. One of the techniques which I've taught, which I use myself, which I encourage you to employ, just one of these other techniques, these other little tools in your workshop, which you can employ from time to time, is when you start meditating, you sit down, you close your eyes, and then, when your eyes close, your body reasonably comfortable, then you contemplate the most peaceful time of your life so far, which is nearly always a place of seclusion, just by a beach at sunset, deep in the bush, in the mountain, or in some monastery, some place, some time, when there's no one else around. You didn't have to sort of live up to anyone's expectations or delight or entertain the people you were with. You didn't have to perform. You could just sit down there and totally relax and be in peace. And there are many occasions like that I've had in my life. Just even talking about it, you just go through a whole list of incredibly peaceful moments in my life. So you imagine one of those peaceful moments. It starts giving you the atmosphere of seclusion, the feeling of seclusion, the smell of seclusion. And once you start remembering that, to make this work, you have to fill out all the details. As many details of that experience as you can. The surroundings, you know, were there trees, were there lakes, were there mountains, were there grass? Was it flat land or undulating mountains? Was it middle of the day or middle of the night? Were the stars out? You know, what was the temperature like? Because as you fill in the details, you're reinforcing that image. And with reinforcing the image, you're actually reinforcing that feeling of seclusion. And you do this for about 3, 4, 5 minutes. And because you're reinforcing this perception of seclusion repeatedly over that time, by the end of 5 minutes, you just have it right there in front of you. Seclusion, emptiness, awareness, being alone, no problems, no hindrances, nothing to sort of oppress you, totally free in these beautiful moments which each one of you have experienced in your life. And then you let go of all the imagery. You let go of the location, the place where it happened, or the time where it happened. But what you're left with is just a feeling of peace, a feeling of seclusion. The remnants, the echoes of being in a place where you're totally free. You get the feeling of seclusion. And from that feeling of seclusion, it's much easier to develop these awakening factors of just like mindfulness. Because mindfulness, the word they use is a good translation, that when you're out in the world, it's called muddled mindfulness. The mindfulness is all over the place. You've got to be aware of so many things so quickly, all together. And it's all over the place. Sometimes that's like me, that people are asking me a question. At the same time, they want me to answer to sign a book. And they've got a camera in front of my face wanting to take a photo as well. And there's so many things all at once, and you can't attend to everything at once, and if you try to, you get muddled. But when you're sort of on a retreat, you've only got to do one thing, just sit and be quiet, and people aren't asking you for things. You don't have to perform, you don't have to do anything. So in that singular experience of seclusion, mindfulness has a chance, an opportunity to grow. And again, as I mentioned early on in the talk which I gave about mindfulness, the core fuel, the cause, the ground from which mindfulness truly arises is stillness. When you are still, mindfulness gets powerful. And mindfulness has to be in this moment. It has to be silent. If you're off in the past or the future, you're simply not mindful. You're not aware of what's going on. So the attention has to be right in this very moment, in life as it's happening. And for those of you who haven't heard me say this before, the reason we're in the present moment is because the past is so uncertain. What you think happened probably never happened. Your memory can never be trusted. So what you think happened when you were young, it probably never did happen. You ask your mother, you ask your father if they're still alive, and say, I don't remember that. To you it's real, to them it wasn't. Who's right? Probably neither of you are right. Psychologists who have investigated memories, they know that the past is terribly distorted. It cannot be trusted, and it's a waste of time thinking about. And more importantly and profoundly, for those of you who are worried about the future, who are concerned about it, I say this every Friday night and Saturday when I teach at Nolamara. Now is the time your future is being made. This is the only time you have to do anything about your future. So if you want to be peaceful, if you want to be happy and healthy, there's only one place you can do this, and that's right now. Every time you go wandering off into the future, wandering off into fantasies, it means you're neglecting the only place where you can do anything about your future. Now, it just makes this present moment really, really important. This is a place where mindfulness lives. If you want to create and generate and strengthen mindfulness, you have to be very deliberate in abandoning everything about the future. Care for this present moment and the future looks after itself. Put all your attention in this moment, and I guarantee you you're doing the very, very best you possibly can do for your future, especially on a meditation retreat. So the mindfulness is present moment awareness. And the mindfulness is also without thought. The difference between saying, you know, kangaroo and seeing a kangaroo. The difference between just watching the sky and the clouds pass by and starting getting a whole conversation about clouds and meteorology is huge. Real mindfulness does not need any words. The words are just signposts pointing to a destination. I'll give you an example now. Just listen to what happens in your mind after I say these words. Peace. 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 After you say the word, the mind moves in that direction. The word acts as a signpost, as a direction for you to look. And if you keep looking in that direction, you find what that word is actually pointing to. The peace which you felt after the word had done its job. A little example like that helps to illuminate the difference between the word and the thing. The word is just a signpost. It's a label, it's a description. It's not the thing in itself. So, the usual simile which I use, the joke which probably you've all heard, is about the professor who goes to the restaurant. 5-star restaurant, newly opened up, makes a booking, has to wait for 2 months before he can get a seat at this very, very expensive restaurant. When he gets there to the restaurant and he has to show his ID to make sure it's him who's made the booking, it's such an elite restaurant. And when they realize that yes, he has made a booking that night, the maitre d', dressed in an incredibly sharp suit, takes him to the table and sits him down with utter politeness. And then the waiter comes and gives him the menu, which is printed on thick parchment with gold lettering, in exquisite calligraphy, as you would expect on a top restaurant. And then the professor continues to eat the menu until he's chewed it all up and swallowed it, and then he goes to pay his bill and leave. The reason is because he doesn't realize the difference between the menu and the food. In the same way, a person sometimes doesn't know the difference between the word and the meaning. Mindfulness stops the words so I can be aware of the meaning. Instead of saying pain, 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 we feel the pain without the words. Instead of cold, we feel that without any words. We know things without giving them labels. It's secluded, this viveka, secluded from thinking, secluded from all these labels and measuring and words which are just added on to existence. One of the advantages of having lived 9 years in Thailand, being put into a position where you're not regarded as an outsider, you weren't a visitor. When you became a monk, you were looked upon, regarded as a Thai. You expected just to know how they thought. And even the language, you had to understand how Thais think before you could really speak the language fluently. And this was a culture which had never been affected by the West. Thailand had managed to steer clear of any colonial powers. So it was a pure, different culture which I was implanted in. And you got shocked. It was a culture shock. And you had to adapt very quickly to see life through a totally different perspective. It was culturally very different. And being implanted as a monk in this culture, staying there for 9 years, you did get understand. And you did get this wonderful experience of being able to see concepts through two completely different perspectives. You realized all these labels and names were totally arbitrary. In a different culture, it wasn't just a different translation, it was a totally different idea. Which is why in some of these languages you just don't have a word to translate this other name by. They just don't have that concept in that language. They just can't see it. Understanding that, you can understand just how the labels, the words, the names really limit you. They put you in a prison of your culture and beliefs which you can't transcend. So in that silent awareness, there really is mindfulness. You are aware, and that leads you in to what really investigations of Dhamma truly is. The non-verbal investigations. It's a long time now since I did this exercise, but I'll do it now to show you what the second of the enlightenment factors is and why it is an enlightenment factor and it's different than what you learn at school or university. I hold something up, and those with your eyes open, I ask you, what is this? What is this I'm holding up? You see what's happened there? You've given it a name. Cup. Is that what it is? That's what you thought it was at school. The teacher maybe drew a picture on the blackboard. This is cup, this is tree, this is mummy, this is daddy. And of course, this is not just a cup. Keep on looking. As you do this exercise, people might think like Chinese cup, you know, maybe 5 inches tall, maybe sort of green, yellow, I can see red colors, there's Chinese writing on it. Probably doesn't mean anything. And you keep looking, glaze, shiny, you keep on looking. First of all, you notice, the longer you look, the more you see. It's much more than a cup. If you just stopped at the first label, you'd only seen a tiny fraction of what this truly is. And you keep on looking, and looking, and looking, until you've exhausted all the labels. Once all the labels are finished, perhaps now you can start to see what this is. Have you ever noticed the labels actually hide the thing? They don't really disclose what it truly is. They just give an alternative description which is totally inadequate of what a thing is. Dhammavicaya, the this investigation is taking something, looking at it, exploring it, until all the labels disappear. And then you've got a chance to see it. So, pain. What's pain? You've got all these labels which you've got very used to about what pain is. And they restrict you seeing it, what it truly is. So in seclusion, when you've got a bit of time and freedom, when you're mindful, you look at that pain. And you go through all your labels, pain, hurt, you know, gut ache, headache, stomach ache. Go through all those labels until you see it without any labels. Yeah, we can call it just feeling, but that's not really what it is. You know what it truly is. Just in ancient European culture, I'm sure this is probably in Asian culture as well, they had the idea in magic that once you knew the name of somebody or something, you had power over them. Once you knew what a thing was, truly was, that knowledge does give you a sense of power and freedom. One of the reasons why pain affects people, because they don't know what it truly is. They think they do. They've given it labels. They've concepted about it, conceptualized about it, but they haven't really seen it. Because it's the labels, the old habitual reactions, giving things a name, which has restricted your understanding. So in order to get the insight, and to have Dhamma Vicaya really working, we have to have this mindfulness which totally overcomes all the labels. So it can actually see things beyond our cultural perspective, beyond our learning. I've had just a little aphorism, the sort of, you know, just short saying, the sorts of sayings which appear in books every now and again, Ajahn Brahm said, or which, you know, go on the calendars. But I like it, and it's a very good one, and it's never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Never allow knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Making a very clear distinction between your knowledge and what truth is. Your knowledge is all these labels which you've learned, all these old ways of looking at stuff, all the old conceptions and frameworks, what's written in the books, who said what. Put all that aside. Let all that labels go. Everything you ever knew about a cup, put that down. And then Dhamma Vicaya can actually start to work. You really are playing with something. The mind is investigating it without words so it understands and feels it. When you've gone to where the signpost has pointed to, you've gone to peace, you've gone to stillness, then you have some understanding what it is. Then you can come back afterwards and give it names. In the world of the mind especially in the jhana realm, it's fascinating because it's such an unexplored realm, especially for the West. Buddhism, in Eastern languages, they've explored it because Buddhism has been there a long time. But in English, just the language just hasn't ever gotten that far. So it's very tough to explain, say, what a jhana is like. Because all the words you use are words which are commonly employed for this outside world. And really, they just don't fit. You're going through like an alien land, the world of jhanas. And to be able to get a word to explain it is very, very hard. But people succeed. And one of the things which I enjoy is when someone's got into these jhanas, just seeing how they explain it and what they say about it. I remember this one sort of visitor to Bodhinyana some years ago. He really did get into a jhana once, down in the visitor's block. You know, I don't often say that because sometimes I maybe may not be, but that was a dinky die one. And then I said, what was it like? And again, he was struggling to say something. But then he said, it just felt, I was just apart from everything. I was secluded. And I just laughed. Because exactly, that's how the Buddha called it, like seclusion. He hadn't read that in the Buddha's teachings before. And I said, look, you know what that word, viveka, means better than any Pali scholar. Because you've been to the destination first and then you found the signpost. Usually people look at the signpost first and then try and get to the destination. But you got the destination first, so now you know what the signpost actually means. So that's what it's actually like, this Dhammavicaya business. If you think the Dhammavicaya means contemplating, naming, you know, coming, going, rising, falling, all that sort of stuff, that's just so superficial. Just say, like saying this is a cup. This is much more than a cup. So who are you? Do you really know who you are? If you do, you haven't got a clue what Dhammavicaya is. So all these assumptions, all this stuff you were taught you were, and sometimes people believe that, you know? They believe you're an alcoholic, they believe you are bipolar, they believe you are schizophrenic, they believe you're angry, they believe you're clever, you're smart, you're beautiful, you're old, you're smelly, or whatever else it is. People actually believe that. That's why they become stupid, they become those things. So don't believe anything. Who you are, that's something you just got to keep on contemplating. Those are just labels which people give you. So what you need to do with Dhammavicaya, just hold something interesting in front of you. That's why I've mentioned already, when you get really strong mindfulness, you know, you look at the bamboo floor. It's much more than a bamboo floor. It's huge. You just go outside and just, you know, you see, you know, a kangaroo turd on the lawn. Have you ever noticed just how much is going on in just that one blob of kangaroo shit? It's incredible just the texture of those things and what's going on in there. It's a huge world. This is what happens with mindfulness. It's not just something yuck and you move on. You can stay with it and investigate it and get really into it. And if you want to find some wisdom and understanding, that's what you have to do. Take something, keep it in front of your mind with some stillness. The mindfulness is strong. And then you can start to really bore into it. And it's not just you start giving these labels. It's not as if that you sort of, you know, from outside, from your mind, you say what this cup is. The cup starts to tell you what it is. You're just totally passive and it's starting to teach you. The kangaroo turd is time to teach you. Your mind, your body, is starting to tell you what's going on inside, what it really is. So you don't say anything at all. It's like the thing speaking to you. I'm doing this in a metaphor. You're not going crazy. You're not going schizophrenic. You're not hearing voices. It's just the insights are coming, understanding what it truly is. And of course, that becomes incredibly interesting. Once you get into this whole path, it becomes fascinating. So fascinating and interesting and absorbing. Just your energy levels go up. This idea of virya, we're now at number 3 of the awakening factors. It's not sort of something which you make happen. Energy is not something you produce by willpower. Please understand that that's an important point, because most people think if they're going to be energetic, they've got to make themselves energized. They're going to get up and force their mind. Come on, mind, get going. Come on, get up earlier. Get the alarm clock going. Jump up first thing in the morning when the alarm clock goes up at 4 o'clock. Zippity-doo-dah, what a wonderful day. Say it loudly so everyone in your cottage can hear it. You'd just be a pain in the neck if you did that. But sometimes people think that's how they start energy. And that doesn't work. That's like a false, like a fake energy. But the real energy comes just by this beautiful practice. It's really interest, involvement. Your mindfulness getting strong. Just things grab you. Wow, look at that. That's why I mentioned to the monks over in Serpentine, it's an observation just because you know Pali very well. Virya comes from vira, which is like the hero. It's a word for, you know, the hero in sort of Buddhist literature, the vira. So it's like a heroic effort. And the reason why they call people heroes is because they sacrifice something very close to them. Usually they give up their whole life for some sort of cause. And it's that type of energy, the energy based on giving up, of renunciation, thinking to keep nothing for oneself, that abandoning, letting go energy. If it's from willpower, it's a very much an acquisitive type of energy. And it's sometimes a very harmful and hurtful energy when it comes from your willpower. When it comes from letting go, it's this incredible sort of sacrificing, letting go, interesting energy. The same sort of energy which you see when people say, it's not my duty to help wash up today, but I just want to do it. I don't know if, you know, you always think you should only do your duties on this retreat. It's not my turn to do the washing up today, therefore I'm not going to do the washing up. No, sometimes you just, I want to wash up. I'm going to help you, even though it's not my job. And that type of energy, that heroic, selfless, just doing it for the sake of doing it, that's the type of energy which we're talking about here. It's the energy because it needs to be done. You love doing it. The Dhamma Vicaya has got you so into this lack of, you know, concepts and all this, you know, these ideas which limit people. It's worth doing, you do it. And you don't do it because you have to do it, because you're interested in it. It's a beautiful thing to do. Washing the dishes, wow, that's cool. You may seem weird, but this is actually what you get into when you sort of get this awakening. The things which for many people were chores and I don't want to do this, that sort of comes from such negativity. When the joy starts coming up and the mindfulness and the stillness, you just want to give, you just want to help, you just want to do what needs to be done. And to others it appears like a heroic energy. And this is all coming because you're awakening up to the truth of things. You're awakening up to life. Life is not doing something to get something back in return. Life is doing it because you love doing it. Not to get anything, not because you have to, not even because you want to, you just do it. And it becomes this heroic energy. And that sort of heroic energy translates into your meditation. What are you meditating for? Sometimes people actually, they argue with me. They say, well, if I let go, I'm not doing anything. I won't have any energy. I'll just fall asleep. It seems that way logically for many people. If you don't have a goal, you won't have any energy. If you don't somehow have a purpose in life, you just stagnate and just become like algae, sort of growing on like scum on the surface of this bamboo floor. But that's not what happens. When you have this letting go, this is another type of energy, the heroic energy starts to happen. Just the joy of doing nothing. There's never a dullness, never an algae. So there's this powerful sunlight comes up from in you, the nimitta, the power in your mind, when you truly let go. So if you're just letting go in the wrong way, yeah, you'll become dull. You become lethargic. When it's done in a proper way, like I've been suggesting, it gives you more and more energy. And that's the virya which we're talking about, the selfless, the energy from letting go. And of course, once that energy starts to happen, you are waking up. You're waking up in a Dhamma way, not through a forceful way. Mindfulness is getting strong. You can actually take something and see it very deeply. The energize, it gets interesting. Even something like the breath. What is the breath? Do you know the breath? It's incredibly powerful and deep, the breath. I've been watching the breath for years and I still haven't fathomed its very depths. It's a powerful thing. So you can just watch the breath and just the mind just goes into it. This is Dhamma Vicaya. It doesn't give it names. It's fascinating. Anyone who thinks just breath go in, breath go out, all the breaths the same, they're not the same. Even just one part of the breath is totally unique. There's never been a moment of breath like that ever in existence before. And when your mind wakes up, you can see that. It becomes fascinating. And actually, the more simple it is, the more fascinating it becomes. Because other stuff is too complicated. Ajahn Chah gave a simile. Because in the forests where we lived, many, some of you have been there, the forests have got thinned out and they're much more tame since I was in there. In those forests, you had to sweep the paths. That was your job every day. And the reason you had to sweep the paths was because once they were swept, if there was a snake or these ants or scorpions or centipedes or whatever on them, then you could see them. Imagine just, you know, in a real forest, there's so many leaves and twigs, you won't be able to notice what's crawling under there. There's too much camouflage. But when you swept the path, it was like a white ribbon because the soil was this white sand, very fine white sand. And then once it was swept, it was like this white ribbon. That's actually one of the reasons I could walk back, you know, under starlight without a flashlight. Some people wonder, just how can you do that? You know, no shoes, no flashlight. How can you even find your way back? It's because, you know, the soil was white and swept every day. Whatever light it actually reflected back, there was a contrast there which could actually guide you back to your hut. But every now and again when you're sweeping that path, you'd be sweeping, sweeping, you'd turn around and a leaf would fall on the path just behind you. Just after you swept it. I was Westerner. So what do Westerners do? We go back and sweep it up again. And that's a total stupid thing to do because we're just perfectionists. We've made that beautiful path and something spoils it. We have to go back and clean it up afterwards. The time marks, they just carry on. Yeah, of course leaves will fall on it. They fall on it all the time, so just leave it alone. But when we pointed that out to Ajahn Chah, he gave the simile. He said, yeah, exactly. Because when your mind is cluttered with so many things, just one thought, one perception arises, you can't make any sense out of it. Because it's one perception cluttered with many other perceptions. But if your mind has been swept clean, like one of these forest paths, silent, still, and just one little perception or thought drops down like one leaf in the middle of a clean white path, it stands out. You can see it clearly. You can investigate it. So that's why we need stillness to understand. Too much information, too many things going on. Our mind is cluttered. No way can we understand things. Too much going on. An empty path, and one little twig falls on it. You can see it clearly. You can understand it. You can get into it, Dhamma Vicaya, and you know what it means. So that's where our wisdom comes from. So that wisdom energizes. And of course, as many of you have probably already experienced, sometimes when you get a little bit of insight, certainly always happens to me, when I say, oh yeah, you just get this big burst of joy. Whenever you're still, you get this incredible happiness. Whenever this energy starts to arise, it always comes with happiness. This is that, what is it, one, two, three, four, fourth factor of this sevenfold awakening? Joy, piety. And sometimes that joy is so strong, it does make you cry. I cry. I mentioned to people just a couple of places which I guarantee will make me cry. This is when you go on pilgrimage. Number one, the Vulture's Peak. Every time it happens, I've been up there. I don't know why the Vulture's Peak. In other places, like the Jeta Grove, now that doesn't get me, but the Vulture's Peak always gets me. I mean, this was a place where the Buddha meditated. It was really simple, not just like some monastery, just a couple of caves. And it's not even very tall. There's other peaks higher than that. But that's the place where the Buddha lived. And actually, there was, for those who've been up there, I mean, been up there years ago, and had like a stone, it actually looked like a vulture, like a carving. It's just, you know, a stone was up there. I think it's broken off now because so many tourists don't know what they've been doing to it. That's why it's called the Vulture's Peak. Not there was vultures up there, but it was like a stone which looked like a vulture. So you're absolutely certain. I mean, that's where the Buddha actually lived and meditated. And you can put your bottom on there where the Buddha sat. Now, I mean, that's really sort of powerful when you really get that into your head, especially being a Buddhist for so many years, especially when you've got some good meditation going for you. And that is really powerful. You know, people actually go to these places, but you're not just worshipping, you're not just paying money and taking photographs, you're actually putting your bum, crossing your legs and meditating where you know the Buddha sat. Ooh. an ex will really get so much pity, so much energy, you start weeping. There's one lady, I won't say who she is, but many of you know her very well. An old English lady. She went on pilgrimage with me once to India. And I told her in just a little talk beforehand, just so that people would know what to expect, I say there's some very powerful places over in India. And she said, some of those places, they will just get you. And you will just start getting so emotional, you will weep. And she told me, said, you're crazy, Ajahn Brahm. It's only old ruins. Now, she's from England. Now, she'd been to all these old castles, all these famous people lived and died, and so what? It's just an old ruin, that's all. And she had to ask forgiveness of me. Because the very first place they went to, in the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya, she walked in there. Bah, bah. She couldn't stop crying. And he's so sweet. She said, I'm sorry. You were right. And it's true that some of these people really get you. And what they're getting is this incredible pity. There's something in there which just resonates deep inside. And it's incredible, powerful. Sometimes that happens in meditation. You get a real insight. Wow, this is brilliant. This is really good. Sometimes you hear a Dhamma talk. And sometimes just what you hear is just so sweet. It inspires you just so much. You just, tears start rolling down. That's what happens. That's pity. And that's beautiful. And don't think you have to be a female to cry. Men do it as well. I do it. But it's from inspiration. And that's par for the course. So if you see anyone crying in this retreat, and they usually do, tears streaming down, don't put your hand around, oh, you poor thing. Get out of the way. They're having a great time. This is not some sort of funeral service where you've got to sort of give sympathy. You're the one who needs sympathy because you haven't got that pity yet. So they're having a great time. Leave them alone and think, wow, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. They're having some amazing sort of stuff coming up. So that just, not just like with tears, it's something incredible joy and bliss comes up. That happiness is par for the course. It's an awakening factor. It's an enlightenment factor. It's there. It's supposed to happen. It's good. Don't think I'm enjoying myself. It must be sort of bad for me. Don't think whenever you get happiness or pleasure, you'll get attached. No, this is supposed to happen. Get into it. Have fun. This is par for the course. You're supposed to have this. The Buddha said there was two types of happiness, pleasures and bliss. The one you should indulge in and the one you shouldn't. The one you shouldn't, you know, is sexual fantasies, eating too much, sort of listen to music or just watching movies, that sort of stuff. That's sensual, okay? But this is the other stuff. You know, the beauty of the mind, the bliss of letting go, just the sheer ecstasy and deep meditation, the inspirational happinesses, a great talk, beautiful meditation. Well, for all of you who've participated in building this place, you know, just even now, just I look at this place, it's a huge amount of work which I put into this and many other people. Look how beautiful it is. And how it's actually being used. People are meditating here and they're getting real Dhamma. Wow! That I was privileged to be part of this. Wow! You really get into that and you get energized, you get inspired. You get joy coming up. That is wholesome. That is good. If you're going to think about anything during this retreat, just think of all the amazing, great stuff you have done. And that just builds up this joy and happiness. That is what we are supposed to be doing. That's what we are encouraged to do. So if ever during this retreat you get dull and bored, just think of what you've done and all the good karma you've done in the past. And if you sit there and you can't think of anything you've done, get a broom and sweep something. Just get a dishcloth and clean up some dishes. There's always some dishes somewhere to clean up. Just do something. Do some good karma. And it gets big. Give a donation in a donation box. If you can't afford it, all you need to do, get a piece of paper, say, I owe you, as soon as I can afford this. Do something to get some joy coming up, some energy coming up. And that's called pity. And that's par for the course. It is something which I always knew instinctively. Anyone who is in line is happy. It's part of the course, it's an enlightenment factor. They're joyful. So if you see any misery guts, any just sourpuss who comes along and says, I'm enlightened. Of course not, no way. Just know, enlightened people are joyful and happy. And Ajahn Chah was full of joy. So that's par for the course. So cultivate it. If it doesn't happen naturally, do these reflections on just the power of what you're doing here, all of the contributions you've made to Dhamma throughout the world. Get into it. Think of it. All those places you've been on pilgrimage, just visualize Vulture's Peak. Wow, I can visualize it now. Wow. And straight away you get this energy coming up, this joy coming up. That's a great place to start meditating from. You're building up an awakening factor. You're cultivating it. And it works. You don't get sleepy, you get really inspired, uplifted, joyful. You meditate, you just blows off into the stratosphere. And you get this tranquility. The tranquility of the body, first of all. It's fascinating to actually to see people sitting perfectly still. And people who know nothing about meditation say, how the hell can you do that? Are you using force to hold yourself still? I said, no force at all, just sitting perfectly still. We got our predecessor once, we had this, he was actually a very still man, Ajahn Chakra, because we did this, we had this video of him once, and he was giving a talk. And just for a joke, like an hour talk, just for a joke, we put it on fast forward. And usually, if you do a fast forward on somebody, you'd always see them jiggling about all the time. But he was actually perfectly still. It was really amazing to see. Totally different than an ordinary person if they was sort of took a 30 minutes movie view and put it on fast forward. And that really showed that that guy had some physical tranquility. And if you took a picture, somebody meditating, especially if they're in samadhi, and put it on fast forward and super fast forward and triple, quadruple, 10 times fast forward, you probably wouldn't even see a movement at all. And that's amazing. And how can you do that? Not by holding your body still, but totally letting go. Until your bodily awareness totally vanishes. You've got this incredible joy. Because you're joyful, you don't want to do anything. Why would you want to go anywhere when you're having so much fun? In fact, you have so much fun in meditation. Sometimes, again, you don't want to go to sleep. You don't want to sort of even chant. If that happens to you, and it's chanting time, don't get up. Don't get out of your meditation. I totally understand what you're doing. Just carry on sitting there and pay no attention whatsoever to the chanting. If in the morning you're having a great meditation, it's talk time, don't open your eyes, just carry on meditating. The whole reason you give these talks is so you can do things like that, so you can sit so peacefully and quietly. What was it, that story of that Vietnamese monk early on, a few years ago, Ajahn Sujata told me this story. He started a 9-day meditation retreat. Just as we do over here, you just get your sort of basic instructions from the manager. You come here, do a little sit for half an hour, then he gives his first talk. After 1 hour, he hadn't opened his mouth. He was still sitting perfectly still. 8, 9, 10 o'clock, he still hadn't opened his mouth. So everyone went to bed. When they got up, he hadn't said a word. When they got up in the morning, he was still sitting there, hadn't moved. He sat there for the whole 8 or 9 days, never went to the toilet, never opened his mouth, never moved an inch. That's a monk. He got into his deep state of samadhi. He was just so joyful, so busy, just sat without moving for 8 or 9 days. And that happened. Isn't that brilliant? Isn't that good? That's what happens when you get incredible pity and energy. Everything becomes totally tranquil and still. And that tranquility of the body. Now you can never have so much comfort of the body as when it's that still. Right now, sometimes you do this as a little exercise. Have a look around and see what people are doing. Changing their arm position, sort of scratching their ear, just scratching their cheek, moving their head up and moving their fingers. I'm just watching what you guys are doing. I do the same. Why do we always have to move? Why can't we stay still? And the reason is because our body sucks. It's always sort of, you know, asking for some attention. It's always itchy somewhere, achy somewhere else. But because we take that for granted, we've always been like that. We never realized just how this body is irritating. If it wasn't irritating, we wouldn't have to put our hands to our nose and yawn. We wouldn't have to even just move our hands or move our legs, just what you guys are doing. Or scratch, you know, move your glasses and scratch your nose. We all do that. Why? It's because our body is irritating, but we do it all the time so we don't actually notice it. Once you're tranquil, you don't have to scratch anything. Everything is just so still and peaceful. You know, that's such a relief. You know, not having to sort of scratch your nose, not having to move your arms, not having to fiddle with anything whatsoever. Everything's totally at peace, totally tranquil. So that's the time your body is the happiest, in tranquility. And where does that come from? Just from the great joy, the energy, the mindfulness, just being. And that's one of the great signs your meditation is working. You can sit here with no effort, no irritation, your body just vanished at last. It's usually the nimitta stage when that starts to happen. Maybe delightful breath, you're pretty tranquil because you're just watching the breath. The rest of the body disappears. It's a wonderful state to be in. May each one of you at least get to that stage. Sitting here, the body just totally relaxed and comfortable. And amazing things happen when this, you get to those sorts of stages. Because, you know, I'm getting old. My legs begin to ache. So maybe after an hour, you know, you start to get a few aches and pains. So you usually have to move. But that's if you don't get into samadhi. If you get into samadhi, deep meditation, it was really weird, you know, 3 hours and 4 hours. When he came out afterwards, oh, this is going to hurt. I haven't moved for 3 or 4 hours. And you come out, and there's no pain or ache at all. And it's sort of counterintuitive. You think the longer you're sitting absolutely still without moving or stretching anything, the more stiff you would be, the more aches. But it doesn't work that way. Because once you get into samadhi, I don't know exactly what it does to the body, but the body just really, just all the energies flow and pain and sickness and all sorts of stuff disappear. So you don't have to be afraid of tranquility. Tranquility's happened, your body's really still. You're going to come out and it's going to be the best ever. And it does happen that diseases go in that tranquil state. So sicknesses and stuff sort of tend to disappear. It's a great place to hang out in. So it's pleasant and it's beneficial. And of course, from that degree of tranquility, you know what happens next. When the body is really still, you don't have to bother with this body. You don't have to be concerned about what you see and processing all this sight. You don't have to worry with all this hearing business. You don't have to worry about feeling the body. Amazing just what freedom you have. If you think you've left work, you haven't left work. This body is your office. This is your factory where you have to work very hard. So you haven't really gone on retreat yet until your body disappears. When your body disappears, now I'm free. Don't have to feed it, take it to the toilet, scratch it. No more aches, pains. So when you get that degree of stillness of the body, stillness of the mind follows pretty quickly. And that's the samadhi. Now you're really waking up. Your mind is waking up. It's like it's been in the prison of this body. And it's a very oppressive prison too. I always say that it's like you're in this prison made of 5 walls with a guard who's sadistic. He's always torturing you. Never lets you rest for 1 second. Always telling you what to do. The guard's name is Will. And you assume that Will is your friend. That's your delusion. It's my will. It's great, my will. It gets me all these things which I want. It's not. It's actually a torturer. And it keeps you inside these prison walls made of the 5 senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Those are the 5 walls of your prison. and you can't see beyond them. And one day, what you actually do, you sort of almost like give this guard a sleeping potion. You send the will to sleep. Let go, let go, let go. Until the will has stopped. And then you can go beyond the five walls of your prison, beyond seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, into the incredible world of the mind, of the sixth sense. That's what meditation is like. You have stillness. Body disappears until you get the mind. And once you start to understand what this mind is, this great emperor, the power underneath you, find out what makes you tick, who you are, then actually you get all the wisdom you can ever want of Buddhism. The idea of anatta, non-self. God, you see it. It's not a signpost anymore. You've gone to the destination. You understand about all this, not just impermanence, but things vanishing. And just the suffering, the irritation of having a body, the suffering of having will, that will is a torture. It's the cause of suffering, of dukkha. Craving causes dukkha. Seeing all of that, you come out afterwards, upekkha, equanimity. This is just the way the body is, the way the world is. It's not a problem because there's no one in there who owns this body. Just the same, it's nothing you own. It's, say, I saw a bottle on the road, but it's on the council's property, nothing to do with the monastery, so I didn't pick it up. Maybe that was lazy, I don't know. But anyway, because it's not my problem. Not my concern. So your body and your mind is not your problem, not your concern. So you're free, equanimous, enlightened, nothing to do, nowhere to go. So they become like the awakening factors. And the reason why the Buddha used that as a counterpoint to the five hindrances is where the five hindrances go, that's what happens. You have the enlightenment factors or awakening factors. Cultivate the awakening factors, suppress the hindrances. So there are two opposites. One to overcome, pointing them out, why you should overcome them, why they're an obstacle. The other one to cultivate, how to cultivate them, why you should cultivate them, and why when they're fully cultivated. That's what enlightenment feels like. Mindful, aware, awake. Being able just to see deeply into things. So this whole source of wisdom is there for you at all times. Having this energy, selfless energy to give. Having the joy, the pity, the tranquility, the peace. And having stillness of mind, samadhi, and this beautiful equanimity. So people call you, stupid pig! Or they call you, you're the best monk that ever lived. And it's all the same. So, those are the seven awakening factors. With a few little things which you can do. Such as remembering the most peaceful place you've ever lived. Inspiring yourself. Using all your good karma to give you energy and joy. Not being afraid of joy when it happens in your meditation. If it's tears of joy, just go for it. Don't block it. This is great. This is supposed to happen. Let it come. Bliss out. Have joy. Just watch the body become so still. When things disappear, don't get afraid. This is what's supposed to happen. The mind will get so still. Nothing will move. Don't take will to be a friend. Will is Mara. It's the enemy. Just let it all go. And then you come to this beautiful place of just equanimity. Just like the Buddha said, like a rock. The four winds from north, south, east and west blow and howl, but they never even make that rock shake. Total equanimous. So that's the talk today on the seven factors of awakening. May you all have all seven on this retreat. Wouldn't it be nice? Okay. Any questions about what I've just been saying? Okay, so sadhu now. When do the sadhus? Ah, come on now. The way I did the three sadhus, we put energy and effort. Make joy of it. Okay, so try again. The three over-the-top sadhus. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. See, it brings more fun and joy. Where are you getting some pity coming up? Okay, so now we have the interviews. So those who want interviews out in the offices, and those who don't want interviews, see if you can get some pity coming up, some joy, some energy. See if you can just cry. Okay, have fun.